Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Weekly Pulse Podcast. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder of The Morning Pulse, and your host for the next 60-plus minutes as we go around the globe to discuss the issues related to retirement, the markets, technology, personal finance, healthcare, and so much more. Glad you joined us. Glad you found us. We've got another great special guest this week, Mr. Phil Rovner, engineer, entrepreneur, and musician. An amazing, amazing career, still going strong at age 87, creating, inventing. You're going to love this story. Some great lessons there. Yeah. And of course, we're going to hear from our great contributors. They are really smart and really experienced in their areas of expertise. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this great episode of The Weekly Pulse, where we're going to kick things off with Mr. Devin Banerjee. He's a senior finance editor with LinkedIn. Hey, Devin, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Jeff?
I'm doing great. You have a good week?
I did. Yeah, busy, productive. Getting ready for some travel through Europe next week, visiting our teams, and hitting a conference. So just starting to think about that, starting to prep mentally for that.
Yeah, no rest for the wicked. Hopefully get a little downtime while you're out there. But sounds like a lot of fun. And thanks again for joining us on the show. We always love having you on as the first segment. And you kind of lay things out really well with what's happening in terms of social media trends. So what's top of mind for you and the folks at LinkedIn this week?
Yeah, some really interesting conversations taking place on social media this week and on LinkedIn in particular. First one I'll mention is we looked at the fastest growing well-paid job in the U.S. So there's one six-figure salary job that will see more openings than any other over the next decade, and that we think is app developers. Mm. So the U.S. will add just over 255,000 app developer positions by 2026. That's according to some research that just came out this week. And so just interesting for people who are, I guess, entering the job market or thinking about reskilling. We've talked about reskilling in the past, people who are changing careers and looking to learn new skills mid-career. It is important to note, though, that app developers won't be the fastest growing job. It'll be the fastest growing high-paid job. And again, as we've talked about in the past, nurses, sort of personal care aides, service industries like fast food workers, those are set to grow exponentially. Of course, they are less well-paying than app developers, and that goes into a whole other conversation we've had about the growing wealth divide. But just some interesting stats to think about for those entering the job market or thinking about some reskilling mid-career.
Yeah, well, absolutely. When we're moving, think about it. When you just say the word app, right? That used to mean application for like a computer, but it really is a lot more than that. It's app development for mobile and portable devices, tablets, phones, probably watches, right? The Apple iWatch is an example. Yep. But also Alexa, Echo Dots, those are things that also have some level of app. They're also apps. I mean, they might be voice-operated apps, but they're apps as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, In the finance sector, which is the one I sort of follow most closely, you know, I keep talking to these CEOs and C-suite level people who say every position in their companies going forward needs to have, you know, these people need to have some kind of technological fluency. Hmm. And so I just did this interview with Rob Falzone. He's he just finished up a 5-year term as the CFO of Prudential. Now he's vice chairman there. And he's saying, look, it is so critical for companies, employers, educational institutions, higher ed institutions, to think about technology for skills, because it's not just in the tech sector, mm-hmm. it's in almost all sectors that these roles need even just some fluency, just some digital fluency and comfort. So definitely something for everyone to be thinking about.
Absolutely. What else is on your list of in your bag of tricks this week?
Yeah, we got just a quick one I was going to throw in because it's what you and I talk about all the time. But We were highlighting a conversation this week, new survey from ING, just talking about how the stress about retirement is of course not just an American phenomenon. And so ING was looking globally, surveying 15,000 people in Europe, the US, and Australia, and just looking at differences culturally and differences across geography. So ING found that retirement stress is lowest, it's not low, but lowest in the Netherlands region. About 40% of workers there concerned about their saving and investing for retirement, and highest actually in Spain and France. So not quite sure what the takeaway is here. Maybe you have a takeaway, but I've always looked at surveys done on Americans, and I've always, you know, talked and interviewed, you know, people who are working on solutions for American savers. But this just sort of opened my mind up to how people are feeling globally about retirement.
Yeah, I don't know. The only thing I would say is that I think your point of view might depend on whether or not you have a pension. You know, there are some systems that are really heavily reliant on systems, on pension yep. systems. They have a social insurance type of structure like we do, or a combination of these things. And then also what's going on. Like, if you polled people in Greece, remember there's like all these issues yep. with debt and pensions in Greece, they might have a completely different opinion than people in other parts of the European continent. So very, very interesting. I think it's those – there are some lessons there that we can learn from. And one point I wanted to make in the prior segment, not to go backwards, but when you mentioned healthcare, you know, as we've talked about, yeah. our folks are aging. You know, we're not having – our birth rate is much lower. The birth rate around the world is much lower, I think, in Europe. And I think that's probably why you're seeing those people. As people aged, they need to get some type of care. And so it's either going to come from your children, your nieces, nephews, whomever, your family, or it's going to have to come from somewhere. And I think you're head on. It's going to be nurses and caregivers and third parties, et cetera.
Yeah. And to the point of healthcare, I mean, healthcare costs, just as a concern for people aging. As I mentioned, I think last week I interviewed the president of BlackRock about 2 weeks ago. And the first thing he mentioned was rising healthcare costs. Like, yeah. that's really driving up people's stress and concern. So I think we'll be talking about that topic basically for a long time.
Until you and I are old. Until you and I are old. And I'm older than you are, so I'll be older than you, hopefully, unless I can find a way to reverse time.
Speaking of age differences, there's a topic kind of raging right now that we're highlighting today. This is Friday, which is how the difference between how millennials and boomers and just different age graphics think about their employer's sustainability and ESG policies at large. So this goes to the larger conversation you and I have had about younger people seeking more impact, not just in their immediate role, but also impact from their employers and corporate social responsibility. So this survey we're highlighting finds that 40% of millennials consider a company's sustainability policies when they choose a new employer. And that's a huge delta from 17% of baby boomers who say they consider their employer's sustainability policies. So, I mean, this just has really important implications. I mean, one, sustainability is something, you know, all major companies, in my opinion, should think of as a responsibility. But even just in attracting new talent or talent going forward, the data is showing just how much younger people care about sustainability policies. And actually, I think a majority of the millennials in this survey, yeah, that's right, a majority of the millennials said that they would even sacrifice a bit of salary to work at a more environmentally conscious company. So Very powerful views here.
Yeah, really powerful and important for prospective employers, HR managers, CFOs, CEOs, in a wide variety of organizations. So really important information, and I'm sure more is available through the threads of LinkedIn. And you can always check. Yep. Devin always highlights these things for Monday's Morning Pulse. So we thank him and the folks at LinkedIn for doing that. Devin Banerjee, always a pleasure. We rely on you to really get our show off on the right Foot, and I know you're one of the more popular segments of the show, so thank you so much, and enjoy your week, and hopefully, if schedule allows, we'll catch up with you. If not, have a great trip in Europe. We want to hear about your travails and what that's like as you're taking the railroad all through Europe and going and talking to people.
Yep, absolutely. Sounds good, Jeff.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Welcome back, everyone. And that was a great segment from Mr. Devin Banerjee at LinkedIn. And now we're going to continue on our tech travels. And joining us now, she is the tech reporter for The Motley Fool, Ms. Natalie Walters. Hey, Nat, how are you?
Hey, doing good. Glad to be here and talk about some tech on Friday.
Yeah, tech on Friday. Friday tech. We got to come up with a little brand for that. So what's top of, there's lots going on. I mean, we've got the Oscars coming up, right? It's the Oscars, right? On Sunday.
Yeah.
And we've got other things going on too. So what's top of mind for you?
Yeah. Well, since we talk about content sometimes, I'll mention I saw a really well-written article yesterday about how millennials have lost interest in the Oscars. And I always love articles like that that point out something I didn't even realize. But I think that's true. I mean, I'm not planning to watch it, and none of my friends talk about that. And I don't know if you're planning to watch it, but I feel like it's people have sort of lost interest in the award shows recently.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I'll watch it. Usually I'm zoned out by that time of the night, and I like to watch The Walking Dead. But maybe my wife might watch a little bit of it because she's kind of in that field. But it doesn't surprise me. I think I can just wager a guess. You know, one, it's a very lengthy process, right? I mean, the gowns are beautiful,
yeah.
The clothing is great, the actors and actresses are stunning.
Right.
Maybe it's a little self-congratulatory, and maybe people are turned off by
yeah.
that. Like, oh, we were so great. You know, we're
yeah.
doing God's work. And I
Definitely.
Think the other thing is there's a lot of politics that gets mishmashed in there, and maybe that turns some people off.
Yeah.
Just my
Yeah, I think
thoughts.
I absolutely agree with you. I think both those reasons, and even, you know, people are so used to streaming now and not having commercial breaks and just be able to pick out what they want, you know. Why watch a 4-hour, like you said, self-congratulatory award show when you can pick out your own show with no commercials on
yeah.
Netflix?
Yeah.
But I won't get too much into that. I thought we might talk a little bit about Tesla today because we haven't talked about them in a while. They've been in the news this week. I thought it was interesting. I know a number of people use Consumer Reports to, review any electronics they buy, any cars they buy. And I use it myself. And so this week they came out and said they can no longer recommend Tesla's popular Model 3 car. Mm. And they just think that the quality has gone a bit downhill. And that really echoes what people had been saying in the past year is that because Tesla is under so much pressure to ramp up production, that the quality has gone down a little bit. And so to have Consumer Reports come out and verify that's true, and, you know, Consumer Reports is just so well-respected and trusted, the stock dropped a little bit this week. Mm. And, Tesla's response is that the Consumer Reports review of its car was done, you know, a while ago, and they said they fixed these issues. They realized they had them. They've fixed them now. So they feel that if Consumer Reports did another one, it might be a little bit different. Would you be turned off from buying one if you saw Consumer Reports say this?
Well, I think whether it's consumer, you know, I don't know how much weight. So for me, I just bought a car back in November, and I didn't look at Consumer Reports. I did read, Kelley Blue Book and other reviewing sites and to kind of get a gauge of what I was interested in, you know, whether it was this car or that car.
Right.
But I do think that opinions of experts matter. And, I think that if someone says that Tesla has a quality issue, that's going to be a ding, whether it's Consumer Reports or whether it's KBB or whether it's, you know, Auto Trader or whomever. And I think people are going to take that as a grain of salt. And I think, you know, right now, I guess Elon Musk and the folks at Tesla are a little bit under fire. Elon Musk, I guess, more personally, but, you know, they're under fire for, quality, but also some of the other things that are going on. So, I think it's, you know, these are just the ups and downs of manufacturing in some ways.
Yeah, and they're like, you know, like these people have been saying, they are under so much pressure to keep, you know, ramping up production because, you know, for a really long time they were setting these lofty production goals and they can never hit them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, problems were happening in the factory. They're setting goals too high and people just got used to them not hitting the production numbers. But then people got tired of that. And I think Tesla sensed that and they ramped production up to more than they could handle. But hopefully they've gotten that under control now. And it's true and they have fixed those issues.
Yeah, I'm wondering, there's always, you know, as I manage my business and other people manage their businesses, you've got to look at what products and services you're offering. And they're in a lot of different, they're not just in the car business, but they're also in, you know, SpaceX and trying to go to Mars. And, you know, you wonder how much they can split their resources successfully and focus. I mean, I think it's just challenging. Those are really, all three of those lines are pretty big, lofty goals, you know, in terms of creating a car company, a successful car company, rolling out multiple models before they just had the one model, and also trying to get commercial flights in and around the Earth, the Moon, people on Mars. I mean, those are big, lofty goals.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we can cut them some slack.
Yeah, I mean, I think they need.
And
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I wouldn't. You know, I know we shouldn't. You know, we should never allow for low quality cars to be in working, you know, but I do want to know what you're saying. And maybe I know people have talked that maybe Elon has spread himself a little too thin. Not that he's the only worker there, but, you know, he is in charge of a lot of it and has a lot of say in the companies.
Yeah, I mean, just
how they operate.
You know, that's just the first thing that comes to mind. Again, I don't look at their financials. I don't know intimately what their management style is like. But when I hear, you know, I see and hear, you know, if I go to space.com and I see something about Tesla and then I hear what you're discussing, which is poor quality, that just leads me to believe that maybe they're in a lot of different places and maybe they just need to reassess. And also the regulatory environment, I think, has changed with automotive, you know, gotten more stringent and maybe that lends itself to more scrutiny. Who knows? I mean, I think each consumer needs to take the information that's available, do some research, and then make the best decision for themselves and their family as to what car they think makes sense. If some of the maintenance issues are small and can be resolved and are not life-threatening, you know, every car's got issues. Everything's got issues. So, you know, can you deal with it and manage it and work around it, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, right. And you have to remember the Model 3 is their, you know, cheaper version of the car where they're trying to make these cars, you know, for about $40,000 so that anybody can, or not anybody, but, you know, most people could afford it versus, you know, the other Teslas that are very expensive. So that's something to keep in mind.
Absolutely.
And then also I saw this article this week that really struck me that on CNBC that says Tesla has lost more than 40 executives since 2016. And that reminded me of an article I did last month about all the Snap Inc. executives that have left the company that owns Snapchat. They've had 7 big executives leave in just the past year. And, you know, it's really always just as someone who has been in the workforce now for a good bit. And, you know, if I change a job after a year, I feel maybe a little strange about it. And, you know, you look at these tech executives that have left Snapchat and Tesla, and, you know, they're only staying there some as short as a few months and then leaving, you know, and some, you know, 5-8 months. And, you know, that's just not a good sign. And it just looks so bad for the company to see so, you know, a well-qualified executive come in. And, you know, if they're coming into the company, they're hopeful and they think, oh, I can change this. You know, I'm excited about this opportunity. And then for them to leave a few months later, you think, oh, what happened? What did they see? You know, what did they see behind closed doors that they're running from this company and they don't want to be a part of it? And maybe they don't see how they can help it.
Yeah, I think culture is important. And I don't think It's hard to assess an organization's culture from the outside and through the interview process. You can ask all the questions you want. You can try to, you know, look people in the eye and ask very candid questions. But I think it's really hard to judge an organization until you get into it. And let's keep in mind that technology is a fast-moving field, and so people who are executives in high technology organizations like Tesla and other, you know, may have a lot more opportunity, may be sought after, and may, you know, may get, you know, the golden parachute, or they may get a lot more money somewhere else. And you know, you can't foresee. So I think, yeah, I guess you have to weigh the industry against some of that. But it's never a good sign when people leave a company, because you know, even though people don't stay around for a long period of time, you want, you know, the culture, you know, how the organization flows, that all comes from management. And it's not just the CEO from him or her.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. And it might just not have been a good fit. You know, they thought this is going to work, but then, like you said, you don't really know until you're there and you're going in day to day and interacting with everybody that maybe it's not the best fit, you know, from both sides. But yeah, it's definitely, and you know, I think obviously in the past 5 to 10 years, there's just been such a huge focus on workplace culture and, you know, creating the best place to work, you know, the best benefits and, you know, the best free lunches and everything.
Yep.
And so maybe that's something for them to be looking at.
Yeah, we just, in our previous segment, right before I came to you, we talked about that younger millennials want organizations that have sustainability, meaning they, you know, environmental causes, social causes, that's more important to a lot of people than just getting paid the big bucks and getting a title. So, you know, really interesting. I think it's maybe a sea change, a cultural change here in the U.S., maybe abroad, and something that we'll have to watch for. Natalie, always a pleasure, and we'll check in with you next week, and we'll see how Netflix and Amazon did at the Oscars this Sunday.
Yes, can't wait. I'll be watching.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Welcome back. Now it's time for our markets segment. Join me on the line. We've got the trifecta here, the lead anchor for the TD Ameritrade Network, Mr. Oliver Renick. We've got – hello, Oliver. We've got Kevin Kelly, principal with Delphi Digital, a recent TV star, if I do say so myself, and the president of Money Alignment Academy, Mr. George Grumbacher. Well, hello, everybody. How are you?
Awesome.
Come on, Jeff.
I'm good. Don't sound so excited, Kevin. Don't sound so excited. I'm doing great.
Were you on CSI or something, Kevin?
Yeah, he was on CSI Crypto. Uncovering crypto. We're going to talk.
Crypto markets are up. I'm excited. Don't you worry.
All right. We're going to come to that in a couple of minutes. But let's start with our main man, the lead anchor for the TD Ameritrade Network, Mr. Oliver Renick, to lay out what happened this week. I know he can do that in like 3 minutes.
Right, it's pretty jam-packed week. More pretty wild company stories, stock stories we're talking about today. Capping off a week with this huge move in Kraft Heinz, but otherwise earnings has really kind of been a maybe secondary factor to markets right now. I'd argue we've continued to just see persistent, resilient, and pretty powerful strength in the U.S. stock market since the low. I mean, it's just incredible. The S&P 500 is slowly kind of just clearing just about every technical hurdle that the chartists throw up, and really now participation broadening out. Obviously, a lot of this still has to do with the central bank direction and the Fed's turn towards dovishness. But within all this sort of jubilant response by investors to stocks, our theme that we continue to track here is looking for any signs that markets have to come a little bit more in line with each other in terms of how the stock market has ramped higher, even while investors express to some degree risk-off nature in the bond market, risk-off nature in gold, and a general kind of disconnect between the signals that some of the data are giving us on the economy. We've had a couple rough weeks for some data. Last week's retail sales number was a very big miss. This week, a manufacturing number, there was a big miss. But yet in the stock market, the best performing group are the industrial companies, and right behind it are energy companies. And then behind that is tech, but actually within tech, your best performance is coming from semiconductors, even better than some of the cloud stocks that are also going nuts. So basically, in short, what all this means is that there is, in my mind, there is tension that has to be resolved at some point. You never know when, because markets can stay so-called inefficient for a long time or not make sense, whatever it may be. But there is definitely some conflict with the messaging from the stock market on things being basically in the all clear, or maybe the bond market has got it wrong and things indeed are all clear. And we just had a couple blips on data points that will show later on to be anomalies. So nobody knows. Right now it means higher stock prices and accommodative Fed, and we'll see what happens next.
Thanks, Oliver. Kevin, let me come to you. I want you to pick up on what Oliver had to say and also kind of dovetail into the crypto markets, because we covered that a little bit this week on the Academy. So why don't you pick up, put your equity strategist on, and then you can flip to your crypto hat.
Yeah, it's to Ollie's point, it's a lot of, you know, kind of everything going right now. It's kind of the all asset class rally, right? You've got gold up, you've got, as Oliver was talking about, you got government bonds up, corporate bonds up, stocks are up. So I think what's it's definitely interesting, because obviously over time, you know, the correlations between some of those are either uncorrelated or even negative. So something kind of has to drop here. I think what's interesting is the Fed commentary. Again, surrounding, you know, the uncertainty around rate hikes this year, the potential, you know, ending of the actual runoff of their balance sheet. And if we hit on this theme that we've been talking about, you know, for the last 12, 18 months now, which is, you know, the dollar and you know, recent dollar strength and how that kind of fits into the global, you know, macro backdrop. That's definitely, you know, kind of dollar bearish, so to speak, because if the Fed ends up not, you know, distancing itself from other central banks in terms of, you know, additional rate hikes, if you have the end of the balance sheet runoff in which, you know, it's kind of sucking dollar liquidity out of the system, which is kind of almost creating like an artificial bid for the dollar itself. You could certainly see some dollar weakness, and then you would see, you know, emerging markets and things of that are, I guess you could say, a little bit, you know, less tied to a strong dollar outperform when the dollar weakens, to actually kind of come to the forefront and outperform. So if we do see that environment, you could see, you know, emerging markets start to outperform, especially since people have, you know, reallocated to a degree to international equities, given the kind of recent repricing in stocks. But, you know, with this kind of all asset class rally, it's luckily bled over into the crypto market. And as we've talked about, you know, still look at crypto as a very kind of risk on asset class or emerging asset class, you could say. So, I mean, Bitcoin, you know, Ether, pretty much across the board, you see some pretty incredible run-ups the last, you know, 2 weeks or so. Some, and not really on a ton of headline news, which is interesting. So part of this, you know, part of what we're trying to figure out right now, and I would say I'm a little, you know, kind of hesitant to call this the bottom end for the crypto market and that everything's going to rally higher, because there hasn't been a ton of kind of headline news. We're trying to kind of parse through and figure out exactly how, you know, sustainable this recent rally is. And so I would expect, you know, at least in the near term, things to kind of cool down a little bit, and we'll see kind of how the macro backdrop of the Fed and all the things we just talked about kind of start to play out.
Yeah, very interesting. Real quick question for you guys, and Oliver, maybe I'll start with you. Before I go to, before I come to Kevin and then George, I want to pick up on what people are thinking about in general. You know, there's always, for the last several years, there's always been this kind of, I don't know, negative Nelly type of thoughts around the economy. Oh, this is going to slow down. Oh, this is going to happen. That's going to happen. But to your earlier point and Kevin's earlier point, the economy still kind of pushes through. How much does the economy respond, does the market respond to some of this negative, these negative connotations, these negative comments that come from, you know, whether they're Fed governors, whether they're just like, you know, astute influencers. I mean, is that play at all into it?
If you want to jump on that first, I think there's two things here I would try and separate out. One is the role of sort of this pessimism and doubt, which I would say is kind of analogous to sentiment around a company, where a lot of times if everybody on the street says to sell a stock, that's when investors will take a sort of contrarian stance and like it even more. So in that respect, the very steady but not gangbusters growth rate that the economy has had has always meant there's people who doubt it, because it has never been something that has just roared. I mean, we've had a couple 4% GDP prints here and there, but for the most part, it has been supported by Fed, which people get very sort of cynical and nervous about. It's just kind of a general dislike by a fairly large portion of, I think, the commentariat that is nervous when a Fed is underpinning things the way they see it. But then secondly is actually about the data itself. And yeah, markets definitely do respond to that. They definitely have been responding to the data. And for stocks, they tend to overreact to it. I think an understated part of the December sell-off was the fact that our data was surprising at a negative rate. And the cyclical groups of the market in December specifically that month really, really took it on the chin. So markets definitely do respond to it. Stocks do, sometimes more extreme than they maybe should.
Kevin, you want to weigh in a little bit on this?
Yeah, no, I would agree. Kind of piggybacking off that, some interesting commentary I heard this week, and you know, I don't have the actual, you know, data in front of me or the insight into this, so, you know, Ollie can correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard, you know, more than a few people who have kind of a window into the hedge fund space actually say that a lot of their clients haven't necessarily even participated in this most recent kind of January, or we could say year-to-date rally in stocks, right? So it's another kind of indicator that you look for to see, you know, who's actually participating in this and how, I guess, artificial or on the flip side, sustainable this recent rally could even be.
Yeah, no, I would confirm that. I was just talking with a source who does options strategies for institutional investors, and he said it's hard to get terribly bearish on the market when there are still institutional investors who haven't jumped back in. But the other thing I would just say is that most of those measurements are anecdotal to some extent, whether it's from someone in the industry who sees what they see in their universe of clientele. If it's a survey, even the Goldman Sachs say they only have X amount of hedge funds who, you know, give them that information. So it's always, for me, positioning is a little bit tenuous, but I think that in terms of what I have heard in that respect, definitely in line with that.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
George, let's come to you. Thanks, guys, for that. George, let's come to you. You're the man with his ear to the street. You're the president of Money Alignment Academy, and you're out there talking to Americans about financial preparedness. All Americans. I don't know all Americans, but, you know, I think you certainly are listening to what people have to say. So you heard what Ollie and Kevin had to say. Why don't you break it down for us in George speak?
Yeah, I think it's super interesting. I heard in there somebody say the correlations are often uncorrelated or negative. And so I think that's the way that a lot of ordinary investors feel about the market these days. They have no idea what's kind of going on. I was having a conversation with the great Paul Merriman, who runs the Paul Merriman Educational Financial Literacy Foundation, rather. And he brought up a cool strategy. And this is not investment advice to anybody out there, but it's food for thought. He says that if you're using a target date fund because you want that to diversify your 401k or just be diversified as an asset allocation, consider this approach. And he said, take your age, multiply it by 1.5% by 1.5, and that's the percentage you should have in a target date fund. So if you're 20, you should have 30% of your money in a target date fund, and take the leftover and put it into a small cap value fund. And that is a good way to move out of the a little bit more conservative nature of a target date fund if you are a young person. So that's a conversation that's pretty easy to understand, or it's easy for younger plan participants to kind of wrap their brain around as they're trying to understand the market. That's could be an interesting way for people to play it.
Absolutely. Well, guys, thank you so much. Appreciate all of your insight this Friday afternoon, and wish you guys a great weekend. And we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, bud.
Welcome back. And now it's time for our Roads to Retirement segment. Joining me now on the line is Mr. Phil Rovner. Phil, how are you today?
I'm doing good today.
Yeah, just good? Not great?
Well, I have some issues, but they're minor. I'm not going to complain. I'm functional.
As people tell me, you know, it's any day above ground's a good day. So we're happy to have you, and thanks for joining us. You know, I want to start. You've got an incredible story as an engineer and as a musician, but I want to start with your career. If you wouldn't mind just telling the audience a little bit about what you have done, what you do for your career, and we'll get into retirement later.
You want me to go all the way back?
Well, I mean, you can summarize it. We only have 10 minutes, so we can't do the full 40 or 50 years, but we can give a little snapshot.
Well, I went to engineering public school in my teen days.
Yeah.
But while I was there, I got into playing music, and when I graduated, I decided to get into music. And I started playing in nightclubs and going to Peabody Institute to study and all, with the idea being musician. And I was playing in nightclubs for a year or so, and I met my first wife, and I realized that playing music was not financially sound. So I got out of that and decided to get into the engineering field.
Yeah.
And I left, I stopped playing music. Except for weekends, I kept playing on weekends, and then I went to the work at the Martin Company, aircraft company in Middle River, Maryland, at the time, and I was a member of the flight test instrumentation group, who designed all the equipment that they used for flight testing new, developmental aircraft and missiles and so forth, and I worked there and learned a lot. Tremendous amount in terms of all the various engineering fields, heat, strain, vibration, aerodynamics, propulsion, so forth. And then at one point in the late 50s, I was laid off because they lost a contract. I went to work for General Electric up in Philadelphia in their missile and aerospace division. From there, I returned to Martin's for a few years. Then I went to work for a number of other companies. I actually worked for eight different engineering companies as an employee.
Wow.
And then at one point I decided I wanted to try to get out on my own. And I had been involved, late in my career, as it were. I had developed some loudspeakers, high-end loudspeakers. And one of them looked very promising, and so I left working for other people, went out on my own, and tried to, get into manufacturing and marketing these loudspeakers. And at the same time, at that point, I was still playing music on weekends, and for a number of reasons, I don't want to spend a lot of time, but I developed this item called a ligature, which is essentially a clamp that holds the reed to the mouthpiece of the saxophone or the clarinet. And it turned out to help me play much better than before. And so I initially began to try to market that, which I did. I started actually producing them one at a time, cutting them out by hand and so forth, and gradually instituted tooling and more, better manufacturing techniques to do it in quantity. And little by little, that business grew. At the same time, I was doing a lot of contract engineering for a bunch of other companies like Bendix. I won't go into all of them, but I mean, I did pretty well there. I was able to finance the business and keep it going. I got out of the loudspeaker business. It turned out to be, in my view, a hype industry, which was premised largely on how well people could market stuff and not so much on the performance. And after about 15 years, the ligature business grew, and I was able to stop doing contract engineering, and I devoted myself fully to the ligature business. And also about that time, I developed several mouthpieces for saxophones, which were very promising. They had good performance and so forth. And incidentally, most of the stuff that I developed on the ligatures and mouthpieces were eventually patented. I have at this point 19 patents on that stuff.
Well,
in fact, I have another one ready to get authorized or approved, as it were. And I went into business on my own in 1974, continued until 2014, I finally sold the business to a couple, a married couple, that are now running it and being very successful with it and continuing to grow it. And the product has done extremely well. If you go on Amazon and just Google in my name, Rovner, it'll immediately pop up with all the stuff that we sell, or they sell now. Yep. And it's been a highly successful product, and, you know, I've been, in some respects, I've been very lucky with it. I mean, it just turned out a lot better than I anticipated. So, and then at that point when I sold the business, I retired, but I'm still doing research and development on ligatures. In fact, I just came up with a new one just past week, which I played at a performance yesterday, and it really works great, and it's patentable, and et cetera, et cetera.
So that's it. I mean, that's amazing. Let me ask you about, you know, our show is about saving and planning for retirement. So let me ask you, as a young man, you worked for other companies. Theoretically, they had pension plans, but was saving top of mind for you as a young man? And talk a little bit about that as you progressed in your career. And then when you made the jump to start your own business, give us a little perspective there. Because I think being an entrepreneur, very different type of mindset.
Well, not really. I mean, I was able to rely on my contract engineering to support me. So it wasn't like the startup, you know, had to be up and running, you know, the instant I got into it. I mean, I was fortunate. Excuse me. See, there were a lot of companies around this area, Baltimore, that were doing, you know, either you know, defense work or new product development and stuff. And I was just lucky, you know, I was able to solicit enough work to keep me going and to, you know, finance the business. And I mean, there were times when things got very lean, but. Like I say, with some luck, I managed to survive it.
Now, and let me ask you about your mindset. You know, you sold your business in 2014, and you theoretically were going to retire because you sound like someone who's a go-getter, and you know, retiring or kind of laying low doesn't seem to be in your DNA. How did you think about retirement when you said, I'm going to hang it up, I'm going to sell my business to this young couple or to this couple? What was your mindset? What were you thinking? How were you thinking about retirement?
What happened was the business was at that point in time, I mean, I had 12 employees, and you know, I was let's see, 82 at the time, and you know, dealing with health insurance and all the problems with the, you know, employee problems and everything else, it just got to be burdensome to me.
Yep.
I mean, it just, you know, it got to the point where at 82 years old, I just didn't want to have to deal with it anymore. And I got lucky that the couple that bought the business had been doing marketing for the company for about 3 or 4 years prior to their buying it. And they came up with a, you know, a proposal to buy it. And it looked good. So I said, that's it. But I'm still involved with it. I'm still working, and essentially I have access to the shop, and I still, you know, I act as a consultant, and I'm still able to, you know, come up with new products. In fact, since I sold him the business, there were 3 items that I came up with that are now patented. So it kind of satisfies my passion, you know, for the kind of work that I've done all my life. I mean, I've always been. Ever since I was a kid, I was always in that mode, so to speak. I used to build model airplanes. I used to design my own airplanes and build them and stuff like that. And it's just, you know, just the way I'm structured.
That's amazing. And you still play music, too. So music also is obviously a passion of yours. Talk a little bit about that. Yeah. You know, you mentioned early on in the conversation that, you know, music wasn't a path for you professionally, meaning to do it full time, and you recognize that you had to do something else. But you still continued to play music, play in bands, play all over the place, really.
Right. Yeah. Well, financially, it helped. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I got paid for playing. I mean, there were times back in the late '70s and early '80s, I was a member of a group that we were the house band for the Martin Caterers in Baltimore. They had 5 or 6 catering houses around Baltimore. We were the house band, and we did a lot of weddings, and in fact, we did the wedding for President Ford's son, and we would sometimes have caught 5 gigs on the weekend.
Wow.
And, financially, it helped. I mean, particularly, in helping finance the business. But, you know, it still wasn't something that was financially what I would consider good as a full-time profession. But, you know, as a supplementary, activity, it was great.
Yeah, sounds
and,
like.
And also, I music is very therapeutic for me. I got to play reasonably well, and I got, a lot of recognition for the way I play. And, it makes me feel good, so what can I tell you?
No, I as a striving musician myself, obviously not to the level that you are at, it's therapeutic to me as well. I enjoy doing it, and
right.
It makes me happy.
Yeah, I saw you on the video playing, and you did well.
Thank
very
you.
Well.
Well, you know.
You're good.
You got to fake it till you got to fake it till you make it.
Right.
Well, Phil, I want to thank you so much for sharing a little bit about your story. It's really amazing. Love the engineering, and I love the fact that even in retirement, you're almost redefining what retirement means, because your retirement is not, sitting back on a lounge chair or
right.
Playing golf. It's still striving, still working hard, and being productive. And I love that about you.
Thank you.
And we appreciate you coming on and sharing a little bit of your story. And enjoy the rest of your day. Enjoy the nice weather in Baltimore. And we'll talk to you very soon.
Okay, Jeff. Thanks for your thanks.
All right. Thanks, buddy. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Welcome back, and now it's time for our personal finance segment. Joining me from MarketWatch, we've got Mr. Jacob Passy, personal finance reporter, and Ms. Alessandra Melito, a retirement reporter, both of whom are from MarketWatch, which I said right at the beginning of the segment. So, guys, thanks for joining us again on the show today.
Of course. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's a beautiful day, at least a lot better than it was in previous weeks. Excited for the weekend, but also really excited to do today's show and to talk with you guys about what you're seeing and hearing on the personal finance and retirement front. So let's start with you, Jacob. What's been top of mind for you this week?
Yeah, so I did a story. It's tax season, obviously. So thinking of, kind of different angles to take on tax season. So I chose to do a story this week, taking a look at instances when it makes financial sense for married couples to file their taxes separately. So as many of the listeners probably already know, there's lots of benefits to filing jointly when you're married. And there are actually some benefits you lose access to or get smaller deductions through when you choose to file separately rather than jointly. For instance, like the earned income credit, the adoption credit, the student loan interest deduction. However, despite all that, there are, cases where filing separate is not only advisable, but can actually lead you to getting a bigger return.
Very interesting. Sorry, go ahead.
So one of the big ones is, there are certain student loan repayment programs that basically require you to file your taxes separately. So these plans allow borrowers to pay back their loan as a percentage of their income, and all but one of the plans, which is called Repay, take only the borrower's income into account when calculating the amount, the payment amount, even if they're married. With the Repay plan, it doesn't do that. So married borrowers who file separately will lose access to certain tax benefits, and they won't be able to take in the student loan interest deduction. But if they're in a certain in that one repayment plan, they should consider filing separately. Another example, which is a big one for small business. business owners is if you have a pass-through business, pass-through business owners can deduct up to 20% of their business income. And, this is a big deal for folks who are, like dentists, physicians, financial advisors. But they cannot claim that deduction if they are owners of a specified business. They cannot claim that deduction if their income exceeds a certain amount. So for married couples who file jointly, the limit is $315,000, while for all other taxpayers, the limit is $157,500. So the reason that that's important to keep in mind is because let's say you have pass-through income of $150,000 and your spouse makes $200,000. Well, that will put you, or makes like $220,000 or something like that. That will put you above the threshold. And then that will limit what you can deduct from your income. Wow. So in that case, it would make more sense for you to file separately, so that way you can get the full deduction that you were owed. And that's kind of a similar mentality that goes into considering medical expenses. You can deduct medical expenses if they exceed 7.5% of adjusted gross income for 2018. That number is going up in 2019, but for this year, it's 7.5%. And if you, but you have to keep in mind that that's on your joint income if you're filing jointly. And so, if a spouse, say, they had, $10,000 in oral surgery related costs last year, and they each make $50,000. If they file jointly, they would cut in half basically the amount that they could deduct in terms of medical expenses. And then the last one I'll touch on, because I think it's a funny one, is divorce. I thought that was clever. One of the advisors I spoke with suggested this, but if you're married, you still have to file taxes together or coordinate it. And if you're considering a divorce or you're separated, it's actually a good idea to file separate tax returns, because it makes the divorce negotiations much easier. Consider it being part of the process of figuring out how your finances are split up. And also, in terms of tax-related income, it just makes it much clearer who's owed what, can avoid a lot of headaches. So those were the issues I have looked into this week.
Wow, pretty amazing. Leave it to Jacob to explore every possible angle as it relates to taxes. And just before we go to Ali, Jacob, is it your sense that people are still hiring? I mean, what you're describing, it's almost like a choose your own adventure. If you remember those books when you were a kid, I do, because I'm probably a lot older than you guys. But you really need help guiding you through this process. I mean, so is it your thought that people are still hiring CPAs, accountants, H&R Block, Quicken, I mean, to get some level of guidance on which way to go? Because, I mean, I would have a hard time figuring this out on my own.
Definitely. I mean, one advisor I spoke with, though, made the point that a lot of the groundwork you need to do, you should be doing anyway. So one thing to keep in mind is that ultimately for your accountant, and even to some extent with TurboTax, to some extent filing a separate return will be as simple as the push of a button. Mm-hmm. Because you should be, obviously the standard deduction went up, so a lot of folks will just benefit from just taking that. But you should still be doing the legwork to make sure that you couldn't get more back through other deductions you can take. You should be finding every possible deduction. You should be finding, all the different, you should be considering all of the different liabilities that you have, everything. I think people a lot of these scenarios were situations where the taxes were and the household finances were relatively complicated. If you're a married couple, both of you just have W-2s, you didn't have much in medical expenses, you could probably do your taxes on your own. You don't necessarily need to go to an accountant. But if your financial picture is more complicated, you should definitely go to a tax professional for help. But basically, kind of what I would argue is you know, the vast majority of couples do benefit more from filing jointly, but that's not always the case. And so that's just all the reason why you should be doing all of your homework and doing all of the legwork along with your accountant to make sure that you have all of your ducks in a row and know exactly what your financial picture is so you can get the best possible return.
Well, thanks for that, Jacob, and great work as always. Allie, let's come to you. You've had a busy week as well. I know you're hobnobbing now with presidential candidates, and you're really covering the spectrum in terms of articles. But what's top of mind for you this week?
So I did a story on a report from Pew Research about how millennials stack up against their older counterparts. So I looked at it basically just looked at, you know, millennials, even the youngest of millennials are now adults. So how do they fare compared to the generations before them during the same age? Mm-hmm. And it turns out that, as always, it of course depends. Yep. But what was most prominent was how education factors into how millennials do. So if you are a millennial who is college educated, you are significantly better off than somebody who is the same age but not college educated. And that was always true even from generations in the past, but just the wage gap between the two is significant now. So if you are a millennial college graduate, your median salary is $56,000 in 2018. If you did not go to college or you only had some education, it is $38,900, so about $39,000. Mm. So what was even more prominent of a difference was if you are in a millennial-led household, the median adjusted household income was $105,000 if you had at least a bachelor's degree, compared to about $49,000 if you just finished high school. And the $56,000 difference is way out of proportion with previous generations during the same time frame. So late boomers had a $41,000 difference between college educated and non-college educated during the same time frame. And the silent generation, which is now the oldest generation, had an almost $20,000 difference. So it just seems like that gap is widening. And of course, that affects how people save for retirement. A lot of low-income families and women, they can't save for retirement, or they can't save as much for retirement because they don't make as much, or they have other responsibilities, like leaving the workforce to take care of kids or family members or just other obligations. So, of course, as a retirement reporter, I just noticed that all of this does affect how they will fare in their futures as far as, like, how much they have saved for retirement, or if they could even save at all for retirement. So.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, you know, we've been talking about on the show, not only in your segment, guys, but also throughout the show about some of the wage disparities that people have, whether it's men versus women, young versus mature, et cetera. And it seems like the gap continues to widen, which, of course, as Allie pointed out, has an impact to people's ability to save. You know, if you're not earning enough, you know, and goods are and services are increasing in terms of, you know, maybe exceeding inflation or keeping up, it's really hard to put money away. And that has an impact not only today, but it has an impact 10, 20, 30 years down the road when people are going to retire, because those people are going to have to work longer. But as we know, people can't always work longer. So it's just kind of this cascading effect. And you know, I don't know if it gets resolved. It certainly doesn't get resolved immediately, these disparities, these challenges. I think it's going to take – it's like a, I think I'd kind of get one to get your – kind of finishing off things off with your opinion. But, you know, I think this is going to take generations. It's going to take a lot of education, you know, about budgeting and saving and how to handle taxes, as Jacob, you know, laid out. But you know, clearly talking about these issues is going to be really important.
Absolutely. And that is where we all come in.
Absolutely.
Just to keep talking about it and telling people how they can save, because I think a lot of people, they get overwhelmed with it. Because, I mean, to be fair, it's not like we're just sitting around waiting for retirement. We are doing things in the present day. You know, when I did that 535 article and everybody got mad at me, they were saying that the problem was that they can't save for retirement because they have so many other financial obligations aside from the fact that maybe they're not making as much as their mom or dad did it during the same time frame. So it's not just saving for retirement, it's paying for, paying rent, a mortgage, student loans, obviously just like, you know, groceries and other living expenses, kids, all of that. So
yeah,
it's hard.
Yeah, well, more to come on this. And guys, thanks again for your great writing and great participation this week. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll chat with y'all next week.
All right, sounds good.
Bye, guys.
Take care.
Welcome back, and now it's time for our Legal Eagles segment. Join me now are two retirement rock stars, David Levine, Kevin Walsh, both principals with the Groom Law Group, a Washington-based law firm. Hey, guys, how are you?
We're doing well this week, Jeff. Thanks for having us on.
Well, it's always great to hear your voices very clearly on the show, and glad you can make some time for us. So, David, what's top of mind for you and the Eagles this week?
Well, top of mind for us is, you know, when we're managing so many things and juggling our time, one of the things that we really think is important is the ongoing discussions about privacy. The retirement and healthcare industry has been sort of watching a lot of what's going on, and there's a lot of convergence going on. Because right now, we've all seen in the news, we've seen the discussion about Facebook with the FTC and what's going to happen there. We've seen places like Washington and California with their privacy laws. California has enacted, and now there's discussion of change, although there's pushing from both sides. Washington has its proposal out there. And then you've got things like GDPR and other global initiatives on privacy. So let's bring it down a notch. What are we really talking about here? The question is all about data and information. What do we do at this point with the world evolving? Because retirement, healthcare has always been out there with HIPAA, but the retirement has been in our patchwork world. But you have this question of who is a consumer, who is a customer? There's all these different, slightly very different variants on the word. The real question is, who is covered? And how does this work in the retirement world? Remember, retirement is itself designed around ERISA, at least for private sector plans, to sort of set the rules. But the question is, where does the plan begin? Where does the plan end? Does the CCPA in California apply to anything on retirement plans? As we move to a world where we're trying to provide more holistic solutions, How does that tie in? Because sometimes it's retirement driven, sometimes it's not. And how do the rights of action there apply when ERISA is supposed to control in some cases? We don't have perfect answers at this point. But as it comes to privacy, a key takeaway right now for me is thinking, okay, if you're a plan sponsor, what are the rules of the road? It's given that the road is kind of wide open in a lot of places, what are you agreeing to for use of data? What is your data? What is not your data? What's publicly available? And for service providers, how do you protect data as security, but also what are you doing with that data? And how is that communicated? Because I've seen lots of consultants and advisors saying, let's talk about this with their service providers. And it's really a dialogue to figure out where the right lines are, because there are sometimes great services, but there's sometimes a use of data. Mm. And what happens when third parties are involved? So that's a whole bunch of things out there. Kevin, what do you have on mind on this?
So, David, I think you've really hit on a lot of key points, and I think it's also important to highlight who else is spending some time looking at data privacy. So one place where they're going to spend a number of hours on this next week is you look at kind of the Senate Commerce Committee, and they have a full day of hearings. And then even if we look at what happened this week, I mean, you had the congressional delegation from California spend a couple minutes speaking to reporters about how any federal effort they would hope would use at least incorporate California statute or would allow Californians to stand despite the federal standard. So you've highlighted kind of the key considerations for plan sponsors under the current framework where it's kind of a wide open landscape. I'm just looking ahead to the future where, you know, these things could change.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me you, David and Kevin, you both laid it out for both plan sponsors and providers, but let's not forget the consumer, right? And I know that's not your bailiwick in terms of what you're doing on a day-to-day basis, but that's important too. I mean, people that are listening to this show may just be in a retirement plan. They may not be a plan sponsor. They may not be a trustee. They may not be working for a provider. But it's really – this is really important. How do you – who is responsible for your data? How do you manage your data? How do you protect your data? And knowing not only about your plan but how your plan uses data, I would think is important too.
I think you're highlighting a key point here where, you know, consumers have data and consumers are beginning to understand the value of their data. But I think they're still working on a regulatory framework where consumers can really control the use of their data. You look at kind of Gramm-Leach-Bliley, and what that triggered was kind of a wave of consumer notices. But, I mean, I don't – maybe David spends more time looking at those notices to know how their data is being used. But I think right now consumers are in an educational phase. Yeah. Consumer rights could probably come in the future. David, what are your thoughts?
I agree with you, Kevin. I think at this point that it's an evolutionary phase, and what makes retirement very unique is who's really the consumer. Mm-hmm. For we can get very wonky in discussing this, but realistically, remember, when you're a participant in the plan, at least for plan activities, is the one acting as the party that's actually reaching the agreements. Mm-hmm. So the question is, when does this become a more individualized basis? And this cuts across many areas. It cuts across the discussion with the SEC and Reg Best Interest. When is there a consumer there that's an individual versus when is it just the plan? Versus also for other securities laws about who is the actual investor, because that impacts what type of investments are available. And there's been lots of things there. We've done a lot of work in that space. You then layer on privacy. How do you tie together all these pieces? There's a lot to be tied together, and it's complex. So I think for the individual at this point, it's understanding, well, who's acting for me, when and where, and just getting a handle on where are my rights when there. And there's a lot of it gray, and I think we're going to work out and figure out where it is, because as Kevin started off with, you've got the California delegation out there, you've got hearings on the Hill next week, you've got all these different things out there. There's a groundswell, but how does retirement fit? Because it's a bit of a square peg in a round hole because of all the players involved.
Well guys, thanks so much for laying this issue out. I would imagine that we're going to be talking about this for many episodes to come, and appreciate you delving into the weeds, so to speak, and kind of laying out, I guess, the basic principles of what we're going to be talking about. So you guys enjoy your weekend. Always a pleasure talking with you. I hope you have a great Friday, great weekend. I hope you have good time management and balancing this week and next week, and we'll talk to you very soon.
Thanks for having us on. I hope the rest of your show stays on schedule.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, folks, that wraps up another great episode of the Weekly Pulse Podcast. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for finding us. Hey, share the Pulse. Share it around with friends. There's a lot of great information here. Special thanks to our special guest, Mr. Phil Rovner. What an amazing story. He's an engineer, an entrepreneur, and a musician, and still growing strong at age 87. What an inspiring story, and he's helping to redefine retirement. So thanks for joining us again, and we'll check you all back next week right here on the Weekly Pulse.